Okay, this is side two, tape number six.
Review of communications. We're on side two of tape number three, interview done with Captain W.L. Sutter, done on July 23rd, 1977. Yeah, he says all batteries on the island are discharged and commenced to charge them at 10 o'clock. This is not so because you're actually working the Geyser Government House, and of course all their equipment's battery operated, and did work them all that day and all that night. When he says all batteries on the island, he must be referring to his battery on the island is discharged.
But I can't explain that.
Now, he never stood a watch for 2 days, 14 hours, and 1 minute after that. And the logs start, and the biggest problem I have with his logs after that is he came on. You have to go back to the ship's logs to get this now. He was given orders to take a bearing on something, and at the least take a bearing on the ship. He was told the captain wanted results and take a bearing. And so he whipped out the direction finder and he just took a bearing on the first signal he had. And you know, half the efforts of the Colorado were based on that bearing he took. And he just whipped out that thing and took a bearing off frequency, unidentified, carrier signal, sent it to ship. The captain got his results. And the Colorado spent all of its search time on the basis of that bearing down in the... It's sort of tragic.
Yeah, it is.
But he even said it was off frequency, unidentified, and just a carrier, and it was a poor bearing, no unilateral effect.
Well, we tried to calibrate that set to a Swanson went around oriented to north magnetic. Then we cruised up and down and had him take bearings on us, and he would call them back, and we would take a bearing on him to find out what the error was. But we tried to calibrate the thing as best we could.
Now, I can't find anything in the ship's log that confirmed that, but that's more than once I've heard this, so I don't know what the answer to that one is. There it is.
Hadn't been calibrated.
Like he said, he was using a little pocket. Oops, well, Amelia, she came in. She asked you to transmit now on 7500. Now, of course, that had to be the T-16 transmitter. It had to be CW. So they did, and they sent a series of A's, which she had asked, with the NRUI call sign. And she came back. She said, I hear you. Now, but I can't get a minimum. I don't know if you remember that or you read it just recently in the log here.
I just read it here.
And I'll tell you what happened. One, her receiver, we finally found out what receiver. She had a Bendix receiver on board.
Mm-hmm.
In order to take a bearing, she had switched to loop.
Oh.
It had three positions. It had fixed antenna, loop, and trailing wire. Well, she removed the training wire, so only two positions were active. One would be loop, and the other would be FA, or fixed antenna.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she had a Western Electric T13A transmitter, which had a antenna relay, like your equipment did, mm-hmm. to switch the receiver off the antenna whenever the transmitter is transmitting. And there's really one of three reasons why she possibly couldn't hear you on 3105. One, the antenna relay was stuck in the transmit position, so the receiver never had an antenna onto it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason she heard you on 7500 was because she switched the loop to take a bearing. When she switched the loop, now she had the loop antenna to receive the signal. She was so close to you that she was getting the signal.
Mm-hmm.
But until she switched the loop and went to 7500, She didn't have an antenna because she was on fixed antenna, but the transmitter's antenna relay was stuck over in the transmit position. That's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The other possibility is that her bands on her receiver, when she switched from 3105 band to the 7500 band, she went to a different band. But I've talked to Vernon Moore, who designed the receiver, and he doesn't think, if it works on one band, it'll work on all bands. He doesn't think there's much chance that could be. It's wild. Or that you people were not transmitting a signal that she could receive. Either we're not transmitting, we're putting out enough power to get to her, or we're not modulating at all. Do you have any ideas on that score?
No, I don't have any at all on that. But I do know that she said she was hearing it.
She heard you on 7500. Yeah, tried to take a bearing.
Mm-hmm. But like I said before, we didn't like the shift in frequency because she was coming in loud and clear on 3105, and we were afraid we were going to lose her if she didn't shift her to the right frequency.
This is it. You know, if she's coming in loud and clear on 3105, you should be coming in loud and clear on 3105.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And why can't she hear you? That's the question.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, like I said, if anybody's ever going to know the answer,
I had the finished idea.
Yet she could hear you on 7500, so her receiver's operating. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't she hear you on 3105? The only evidence in the world that you were transmitting on 3105, besides, you know, your own operators looking at the dials and whatnot,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
is Cipriani's log. Unfortunately, Cipriani's log becomes very suspect. Do you know did he actually have a typewriter on the island?
No, he didn't. No.
So the transcription were made from his longhand logs. I noticed that you never signed these transcriptions.
I don't remember having seen them. I might have seen them and forgotten.
You signed all the other transcriptions, but you never signed these.
I say I can't recollect where I've seen these.
Well, I have the orders you gave to him, and the orders you gave to him was to man the direction finder on the island and keep a log of all signals heard. And I do also have a message that you or Commander Thompson or Leaguer Baker, somebody sent to him, told him to get the direction finder going on 3105 and to take bearings on signals heard and keep a log. So he was told by your orders, I have your orders of the day, which is I'm you telling him to keep a log. And in the radio message, which was sent to him a day or two later, they told him to keep a log. And
but there were no typewriter on the island.
Well,
how much this corresponds to ours?
It works out quite well after you stood up to the island. See, what I was trying to make out was a possibility that somehow all that fiddling around with your antenna, that you'd somehow got the antenna disconnected from the T10, and that it would radiate for a couple, three, 4 miles, you know, but it wouldn't put out enough to be received by a media, even though she was only probably 30 or 35 miles away. And when you drifted off during the night and just got 6 or 7 miles away, he didn't hear you anymore. And until you stood up in the morning, now all of a sudden he's hearing you again.
Is that a possibility, even? That could have happened.
Well, it's an outside possibility, because usually on our transmitters, when they're putting out, you got your output meters going, and you can tell if the thing is putting out.
Of course, the T10's behind them.
Yeah, right.
And the receiver's up in front of them, and though O'Hare was suspicious, and that's why he was suspicious of something was right. I show you the other one. He was suspicious of the of the T-16. He kept asking, why don't I'll show you the transcript, and we can go right to the...
Did the soldier actually make a statement to you about this?
Well, O'Hare at one time said that... this is an analysis. This is not a direct... This is an analysis of the DF logs. Not at all. It's too much to go into. Here. This is the way Richard Black remembers the direction finder. He's not much of an artist, but... That was drawn by Dick Black.
Well, it was on a breadboard. I don't remember the teeth about this big, about that long. And everything was out in the open.
About 2.5, 3 feet long.
Yeah. But everything was out in the open. All your tubes were out in the open. I mean, there was no cabinet arrangement. And I remember, I thought this was in the middle. It might have been out there.
Well, I think this is vertical. He meant that was up on top.
Oh.
And this should be laying this way.
This should be down. Because the thing, as I say, what we call a breadboard, I'd study for hand for you.
You
should put your thing in on a breadboard before you put it into a cabinet. But this is a wooden, plywood. Maybe 18... By 2.5 to 3 feet. But imposed on this breadboard were all your tubes, your resistors, your capacitors, and there was no cover. Now, I can't remember anything on the... There must have been some place to dial.
He's indicating those as dials, volume,
so
control,
that would be
tuning.
The vertical part here, this part. Mm-hmm. The rest would be...
Well, I made an analysis of the thing, and it's not, it's a critical analysis of his logs. And starts out and then dates an error by one day. He soon watched a 2200. At 2345, weak phone on 3105 is unreadable. The Coast Guard listening in Honolulu heard nothing on 3105 at 2345. Notes, at 2202, the Itasca asked the Coast Guard Radio San Francisco if they were hearing the Itasca on 3105. NMC answered, signals barely perceptible to not heard. Reception impossible. At 2212, NMC told Itasca that signals from the T-16 transmitter on 12600 were strength 5. At 2230 to 2233, the Itasca broadcasted weather on 3105, and at 2251, the Itasca heard VK. Well, this was VKT, which was Nauru Island. And call Earhart, S1, VK2 is Nauru. And that was when they were transmitting with her. At 2259 to 2305, the Itasca broadcasted weather and A's on 7500 and 3105, and at 2306, NMC told Itasca to send broadcasts on 7500 to 10 words per minute. Shows NMC was copying the T-16 on 7500, and at 2333, the Itasca broadcast weather on 7500 and 3105. At 2400 to 004, the Itasca sent A's, etc. on 3105. None of the above transmissions from the Itasca was logged by Cipriani. In other words, all of that went on between 2345 and 0100, and he didn't log a single one up.
915.
Okay. July 3rd, note wrong date, is really July 2nd. Weak phone on 3105, unable to get bearing. Nothing was heard by Honolulu. Note, at 0015 to 0020, the Itasca reported nothing heard on 3105. But a few minutes earlier, at 008, the Itasca was sending bees on 3105 to get NMC to check on the Itasca's frequency and voice modulation on 3105. At 00:30-35, the Itasca sent Weather and A's Howland on 3105, use voice on 3105, and told Earhart, go ahead using key to answer. From 00:38-00:44, the Itasca was testing with NMC on 3105, setting a long series of V's, etc. And at 00:53, the Itasca, another long series of V's on 3105 to NMC. And NMC reported their signal strength as being from barely perceptible to not heard.
Well, if NMC with 3105?
Yeah.
Well, if he was picking this up very perceptible, that's a long distance from Holland to San Bruno.
Well,
so.
To not heard at all. It was S1 to 0 is what the answer was. But note, at 0200-0207, the Itasca transmitted using voice on 3105. And by the way, that was CWVs, which was a lot more than signal strength than what the voice would have been on 3105, requesting Earhart use a key to be used to answering schedules as nothing was being heard from her. Note, none of the above transmissions were logged by Cipriani. As a matter of fact, he never logged anything. He never logged any of the Itasca's signals until 5:35. At 5:35, the Itasca gave weather on phone 3105, and at 5:40, the Itasca asked Navy Radio Honolulu if they heard Earhart on 3105. Honolulu replied yes, but could not make her out. Coast Guard Honolulu log showed nothing was heard by them. At 05:53, the Itasca heard Earhart, part cloudy. At 5:57, the Itasca sent weather to Earhart using key on 3105. At 0600, the Itasca sent weather using radio telephone 3105. And at 6:03, the Itasca asked Navy Radio Honolulu on 12,600, using the T-16 transmitter, what the strength of their radio telephone signals were on 3105. Honolulu replied, negative, I don't hear you. At 6:10 on 12600, the Itasca asked NMC what was the strength of the Itasca signals on 3105, and NMC replied that reception was impossible on 3105. At 6:26, the Itasca sent weather using key on 3105. Note, none of the above signals were logged by Cipriani on Howland Island.
You ever remember seeing any handwritten logs of Cipriani?
No. Matter of fact, I don't remember seeing his logs at all, but I must have seen them, I'm pretty sure. But I was just comparing them. It looks to me like those logs,
right.
These logs were typed up on the Itasca typewriter.
Yes, so these are transcripts.
Oh.
Yeah, his logs, wherever they are here, these are transcripts of his logs. I've never seen his. The only original logs I have are these here. Okay, at 6:30, Itasca giving weather on phone to Earhart blind 3105. That's in Cipriani's log. Now, you stood up the island then. Itasca log shows that at 6:26, the weather was sent by key on 3105, and at 06:30, weather was sent by radio telephone 3105. At 6:33, the weather was sent by key again on 3105. Cipriani specifically says on phone. Why? In other words, it was sent by CW, it was sent by phone, it was sent by CW. Why did he specify in his log? He says it was just an analysis. I wonder why did he put that in his log that it was on phone?
Mm-hmm.
Almost like the whole thing was all hindsight. I'm not saying he made up that part of the log. Later on, I'm going to say he did.
No.
Not that part, but another part. Itasca giving weather on phone, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well, I skip a lot of this because it's all the same sort of thing. Yeah. And we were able to establish his watch being slightly different than the ship's clocks. Because of the various messages that were going back and forth, Actually, his logs were good enough that, that you could establish that his watch was 2 minutes fast. And, which, you know, isn't bad for a wristwatch a couple days later. It's not too shabby. Okay, at 7:35, the task of sending blind Earhart. Note, at 7:36, the task of called on 3105 voice. Cipriani clock 1 minute slow. The task of ship deck log shows that landing party, including executive officer Mr. Baker, departed ship at 7:10 and should have gotten ashore about 7:30. So,
is that the morning she went in the drink?
Yeah.
She had to remember putting the landing party on.
Yeah.
That's what that picture is of.
The picture shows him. But actually, Cooper wrote a, he went ashore too. And he wrote a complete report to his headquarters, and I found that in the National Archives. And he had, luckily he listed all the people that went ashore and what they did while they were ashore and everything else. Yeah, they sent some people ashore to help assist her in landing. Okay, am using direction finder set sparingly. Note, it is not known how this could be accomplished. The set is either turned on or off. Yeah, this one, this is the same thing you have questioned. How do you use it sparingly? I mean,
yeah, right.
I don't quite know what that means.
Well, you turn down the volume of your receiver, but I mean, you defeat your purpose.
Okay, Earhart's on the air, string 4, give me a bearing. Earhart not test for bearing. Her transmission too short for bearing. Static string 5. Her carrier is completely modulated, could not get a bearing due to above reasons. That's an awful lot of explanation for a short log, but anyway, I won't. The task of log number 1 shows at 7:42 to 7:45, Earhart on now, reception fairly clear now. 7:47 wants radio bearing and wants us to report in a half hour. The task of log number 2 shows at 7:45, please take bearing on us and report in a half hour. At 7:46, I will make noise in Mike about 100 miles out. Cipriani's clock is 3 minutes fast again. Earhart was on the air for 2 to 3 minutes with fairly clear strength 4 signal. Analysis of reasons given by Cipriani for not getting bearing is as follows. Earhart did not test for bearing, whatever that means. I guess she didn't send MOs. She was on the air for 2 to 3 minutes and did make noise in Mike. Her transmission too short for bearings, 2 to 3 minutes on the air. Static strength 5, strength of signal 4, fairly clear, makes this inconsistent. I mean, her carrier completely modulated, that's incomprehensible. It would seem that these are more excuses for not getting a bearing than reasons. It would seem that either the batteries were unable to supply enough current to operate the direction finder or the set was defective. I mean, if you accept what he says, then the analysis says that, you know, either the batteries are so weak the set couldn't operate properly or else the thing was defective to start with.
Well, there wasn't any more, anyone aboard the ship could troubleshoot that set. And I say it's an experimental job put on by Pearl Harbor.
Well, this goes on and on as he's getting into it. What bothers me about Cipriani's logs is twofold. If you take the logs to be accurate, then for some reason or other, the Itasca isn't putting out a well enough on 3105, so once it gets over 4 or 5 miles away, you can't even hear it. Mm-hmm. And he's the only one in the entire world that ever heard him on voice. Hmm. Now, later on...
I want to say that we checked 3105 with the Ontario, and there was a minesweep between halfway between Honolulu and Holland. And they checked that. I don't know where the Ontario was. She was over to the west of us. I want to say that
you
we
mean
checked
the Swan.
The Swan? No, the Ontario was west of us. The Swan was north of us.
Right.
The Ontario was out of Samoa.
Yeah. Right.
But I want to say. Yeah, we had checked with them, and we were putting out on 3105. Now, I'm not certain. But,
Well, the other thing about Cipriani's logs that bother me is that later on, he is standing watches all night long. Now, Black sent a message. No. You or Commander Thompson or somebody sent a message to Cipriani telling him to get the set going and take bearings on our 3105 and set up the direction finder, get it working, and take bearings on things. Because people were hearing a mysterious carrier, and they kept telling them, break it four times if you're in the water, this and that. This is going to get a little more involved as we go along. But Cipriani's logs show that he would stand watch till midnight, and then he would have one of the Hawaiian boys stand watch till 4 in the morning, and then he'd stand watch till, or something like that, and he was dividing up the watches with the Hawaiian boys. Now, Chinese radio operators, actually. And when you sent the message, or Thompson sent the message, or Baker sent the message telling them to do this and to use the Chinese operators if necessary, it said, if you have any trouble with them, tell Jimmy that Mr. Black said for Jimmy to get them to cooperate. Now, I talked to every single one of those men on that island, and I don't think you knew it. I don't know if you ever knew it. I don't think that anyone in the Coast Guard ever knew it. But were you aware that one of those Chinese operators on the island was an officer in the Army Signal Corps?
No.
A fellow by the name of Henry Lau, who's now a retired colonel from the Army. Mm-hmm. He was a second lieutenant at the time. He was on leave from the Army, and he was out there operating as a Chinese radio operator, one of the Hawaiian boys, but he was really an Army officer, Signal Corps officer. I don't think anybody ever was.
No, I was never aware of it.
And he's in the logs, as well as Ah Kim Leong. You may remember some.
No, I don't remember. There were so many of them.
Well, there was four, because the Hawaiian boys didn't like the ship, and when you guys were standing by off the island waiting for Amelia Earhart, they all went ashore because they'd rather be ashore than be on the ship. And so when you left there and went on the cruise, you left about eight of them behind, and four of them were radio operators. So there were four radio operators on the island at the time. And one of them was Henry Lau. Another one was Ah Kim Leong, and another one was, just for the moment, the names escaped me. But anyway, I've interviewed all these people in great depth. And when I show them Cipriani's logs and show that they were standing watches, they all deny it vehemently. They never stood watch one. Cipriani was off in the tent all by himself, and they didn't stand no watches.
Well, another thing is that the names are spelled all
wrong. Yeah, the names are spelled wrong.
Yeah, the fellows that signed them off, they would
have... Yat Phi Lum, for instance, they had him down as Yat Phi Lum in all the logs. And he said, well, in the first place, I think I would spell my own name right. But anyway, he was trying to prove to me that what he was saying was true.
I don't ever remember the Black saying, have the Chinese people stand watch there. So that bug's been out from Baker and the cabin.
No, it wasn't referring to Cipriani. It was in a message, which is... Yeah, it's still in existence. Which was a good idea. I mean, poor guy, he can't sit there on that radio all night long. And if you need some help, get the Chinese out. Well, he in his logs, he indicated he did get help. As a matter of fact, he indicated in the logs that they were sending messages and whatnot. And they deny it. They deny that they stayed. Which makes me suspect his whole logs, that he was of a temperament as such that he would make a log up to indicate that he'd done what he was told to do, whether he'd done it or not, which, isn't all that unusual in this world.
No, right.
But the only reason it's important is, did he make up the log about not hearing the night of July 2nd when it's important. Mm-hmm. I don't. Do you know it? You remember anything about it?
No, I don't remember the same.
Okay. Now the strange part of it all comes to a head. And mainly it comes from the listening station at Honolulu that Anthony sets up. There's this mysterious carrier that they're hearing. And this is why you sent a message to Cipriani to get that direction finder going and take bearings on things, because they hear this carrier and they can't identify it. There's a British New Zealand cruiser, the Achilles, that reports hearing it. And the which is a disciplined ship, you know, if it hears something, it heard it, you know. It's not some radio amateur that's hypnotized himself into thinking he's heard something. The Pan American station at Midway, at Wake, and at Kaneohe heard it and took bearings on it. And it's been heard by the listening station that Anthony set up with Mr. Moore and some of the other fellows there at NMO or whatever they called it. And there's bearings been taking on it. And even Cipriani got in the act and took a bearing on it. But nobody's heard the Itasca on phone on 3105 yet. They keep hearing this carrier, but they don't hear any modulation. It's unintelligible. They don't get anything out of it. Until the morning of July 5th, 2 days later, or July 4th, day and a half, I can't remember. All of a sudden, everybody's starting hearing the task all the time. And for the rest of the whole period, she's a genuine chatterbox. Hmm. But up until that point, nobody hears anything. And it just... it makes you wonder.
Yeah, I can't explain that.
O'Hare had an explanation, and that was they weren't modulating. But Finley just doesn't see how that could be true.
I don't see, because on those transmitters, you can tell when you're modulating when you're not.
Yes, because you hit that mic button and talk into it, and your grid current will fluctuate, right, because that's what's applying the modulation bias
to the
modulator. Well, O'Hare at one time took the position, well, the dumb thing was behind us. And all the switches and the receiver and the mic was in front of us. And you know, I've got eyes in my back of my head. I can't see whether it's fluctuating when I talk or not. And he said, all of a sudden, Bellarts found out that it wasn't modulating, and he fixed it. And, man, he was testing with everybody from then on.
Well, I never knew about that.
Well, I would suspect it. I don't know this true. I can't verify it.
Well, as I say, at one time, when she wasn't hearing us on 3105, that I began to worry that maybe we weren't putting out. But then after a while, it seemed like we were putting out, so... And then she did acknowledge, I think she acknowledged hearing us on that.
No, never on 3105.
Oh, she
heard you on 7500. Oh. You know, there's two things about this report that I thought, one thing I really thought was great about the report was that at the end, you or Lee or Commander Thompson wrote in there that this is as the Itasca saw it. And if Amelia Earhart was here, maybe she saw things differently. And she would have seen things a little differently from her point of view in the cockpit of the airplane. She was as dumbfounded as everybody else as what was going on. Like you say, the basic problem was poor planning in the first place on her part. She was definitely hamstrung in the respect that she... When she was doing all this planning, she wasn't sure whether she was ever going to be able to receive anything. Mm-hmm. And she was of a nature such that would have bothered her. But a couple of things I don't like about the report was that the inference throughout the report that you were being heard throughout the Pacific Basin And you were, but it was using the T-16 transmitter that you were being heard. The fact of the matter was that no one was hearing you except Cipriani on 3105. Even though they were hearing her with her little old aircraft transmitter, they weren't hearing you. But you, and the other inference that really thought was unfair, is that you inferred in the report, I don't say you report, the report inferred that you were transmitting voice on 7500 and 6210 and 3105, and when in fact the only frequency that you could transmit voice on was 3105. And the report is very careful. It never directly says it, but it infers throughout that it was, that voice was used. And this bothered me because I knew when I talked to Bell Arts and whatnot later that there was no way you could transmit on 31, voice on anything with 3105. And he swore up and down, oh, yes, we could. Yeah, we transmitted on. And I know he knew damn good and well he didn't, because he used that T-16 for 15 years. I mean, it was like an old friend. He knew he couldn't transmit on
Well, we couldn't transmit voice.
And yet he stuck with it, you know, to the bitter end that they had. The other thing that the only real mistake that the operators made, as far as I'm concerned, and that I've been able to come up with, is that they never understood that she was on Greenwich time when they, and well, they should have, because it was, you know, it was sent back and forth in the messages and everything that she would transmit on Greenwich time. And whenever she said on the half hour, they couldn't make any sense out of that, so they would infer it to mean in the half hour. And you look in the logs, and 30 minutes later, they would answer.
Mm.
And yet, she wasn't listening. I mean, she was doing a lot of things. She was flying the airplane, had a lot of other things to do besides listening on the radio. And whenever she said on the hour, why, they got it a half hour off, and kind of, that was the only real blooper that I could see that they made. Now, one thing that bothers me about that radio room is that when you switch from the T-16 and the T-10 shared the same antenna.
Right.
And what I gather was a knife switch on the overhead.
Overhead triangle. Well, you had one where you put it off, then you put over this way, you're on one transmitter, the antenna, pull it and push it this way, then you're on the other transmitter.
So every time they switch from one antenna to the other, one transmitter to the other, they'd have to switch the antenna back and forth.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, when they were using voice or CW, I take it the MCW, CW, or A3 switch, or A1, A2, A3 switch was back on the transmitter.
Yeah.
They'd have to reach around and turn it. And then I guess there was there a button of some kind on the microphone, or do you remember? That's awfully hard to remember.
No, I can't remember, but I do think there was a button. I'm not really certain.
And they would know whether it was being keyed or not, because the dynamotor would start up if it were transmitting on voice.
Of course, talking about the transmitter being behind, you have to remember there were two radio men on watch, and one could shift it while the other was on the receiving. You know. You could check out how the transmitter was operating.
This was another thing that's beautiful that I had both logs, because I could tell if one guy was using the T-16 to work Tutuila, there's no way the guy could have been transmitting on the T-10. I mean, sometimes in the log they said, I can't answer, I have to, other stations using the antenna and things like that. But these things help clarify the logs when time. Now, you had the correct time because the logs show that you checked with Honolulu and got a time tick and whatnot.
Well, normally we wouldn't check with Honolulu for a time tick. We have our chronometers aboard, and we always check Washington, Naval Radio Station Washington, every hour sends out a time tick. So, twice a day, in order to make sure our chronometers, for, of course, all chronometers don't keep exact time, either gain or lose, so we take these time ticks. And then from there, the quartermasters set all the ship's clocks to this latest time tick. But normally you wouldn't get it out upon the road.
Well, this was done, the logs show that it was done about 3 o'clock in the morning. I can't remember the exact time. The quartermaster came down and they took a time tick for him and they checked all their clocks. And so everybody's clock.
Well, it could be possible that the radio room themselves could take the time tick from him.
Yeah, well, the quartermaster, he didn't have a receiver or anything. He had to go down to the radio room and do it, didn't he?
No, we had an extension up into the chart room.
Oh, I see.
He could listen.
Growler or something? Or?
Yeah, and he could listen up in the chart room to the time tick. All the radio man would do is put on the frequency and maybe 5 minutes before the ticket was supposed to go on. And the quartermaster would actually do the checking of the time.
Were you in the radio room at all during the latter part of this, or was?
I sure was. I thought Dan Cooper might have said, but of course I won't check if Cooper was ashore. But somebody was standing next to me, and she had an open mouth.
That was the end of side number two, tape number three, we would call it, and this will be tape number four. Interview done with William L. Sutter on July 23rd, 1977. The reason I'm letting these tapes run so long, actually it'd be best if this were the last tape, because this was done in the latter part of July, and I have sort of putting all my own ideas on here and expressing them in Sutter's presence and giving him the opportunity to comment and whatnot on what I'm saying. And so I'm kind of letting the whole thing go because some of these tapes, as you know, date back 3 years or so, but I'm expressing quite a bit of the knowledge that I've gathered over this period of time investigating the communications. Okay, this is continuing now with W.L. Sutter. This is the second tape that was done on July 23rd, 1977, but we call it tape number four, and this is side one.
Captain William Sutter, William L. Sutter. We're at his home in Plainfield, New Jersey, at 561A East Front Street, Plainfield, New Jersey, and it's July the 23rd, 1977, Saturday afternoon now. It's almost a quarter to four, and Captain Sutter has been reading the letter that Commander Thompson sent on October the 18th, 1937, to Admiral Weishi from Port Angeles, Washington, where Commander Thompson was captain of the Ingham at the time. And Captain Sutter has just read the letter here, and we're talking about it.
Well, one part, now, me and Percy in the radio, I know there were some other officers in the radio, and I can't remember who.
Picture, there can't be too many people in there. It's just...
Oh, I think there may be... three or maybe four. As a matter of fact, we had to kick some of them out. So crowded.
Well, this is another problem. Now, here the radio men are trying to, they can't be watching the dials, and officers make white hats nervous. here, put that in there first. They have to get up to throw the switches. They have to get around to select voice or CW. Actually, an officer in the radio room is quite an imposition, really.
Well, not too much. I mean, as far as communication officer, most of these fellows I'd worked with for maybe 8 months, so we knew each other pretty well. Maybe the cabin being in there might be, but there might have been one other officer. I can't remember, but there was room over between the door and the transmitter. You could stand in the doorway, and there was room inboard from the transmitter. One could stand there, and there was one against the inboard bulkhead. So that wasn't overcrowding the radio. We were out of their way. But I see Bobby in the radio room. He probably was. I won't just. And heard all of her translation as she's coming very clearly on the loudspeaker. From the time she apparently reached the end of her dead-reckoning run until she finally ceased transmitting, her voice rose constantly in pitch and quite evident tension. I'll agree with her in that part. There's one thing about where she went down. I never did see the Naval Command report. Where's she? Now, I agree with them here, too. I feel the search was unnecessary up to the time that it was abandoned by the hot command. I feel that a lot of area search might well have been ignored and could not quite agree with some of the naval estimates of the situation.
Okay, that's the end of tape number 6. We're with W.L. Sutter on his tape number 4, side 1. We'll go to tape number 7 and pick up where we left off. So we'll start out now with tape number 7, review of communications.